Maddie is brought to you by 9.com.au. To enjoy some of our other great shows, such as NRL podcast Six Tackles with Gus, or our deep dive into the royal family, the Windsors, head to 9.com.au/podcasts or search for us wherever you listen.
In the following podcast from 9.com.au, we are not suggesting Kate and Jerry McCann were responsible for what happened to Maddie or are lying. Her case is simply a mystery, but they were considered suspects by the Portuguese police, and we examine why that was and why the questions about what happened to Maddie haven't gone away.
We're just hearing that a search is underway for a three-year-old British girl who's gone missing in the Algarve area of Portugal.
Someone's taken her. Madeline's gone.
Words cannot describe the anguish and despair that we are feeling as the parents of our beautiful daughter, Madeline.
Parents of Madeline McCann are now considered formal suspects by the Portuguese police authorities.
We have played no part in the disappearance of our lovely daughter, Madeline.
There are days when you just want to get under the duvet or just want to be in a coma till it's over, just to relieve the pain and get some peace, but you can't.
In March last year, I tried a number of times to contact detectives inside Operation Grange, set up in 2011 by London's Metropolitan Police. The purpose of Operation Grange is to investigate the disappearance of Madeline McCann. After I spoke to Dr. Mark Perlin, a DNA expert you're about to hear in this episode of Maddie, I felt compelled to call Operation Grange. I wasn't calling up as a journalist. I was calling with important information I believed could assist detectives.
This is the Metropolitan Police. If you or anyone else are in immediate danger, or a crime is taking place now, please hang up and dial 999. Please note, all calls are recorded.
My name is Mark Salnokonoko, and I'm a reporter for 9.com.au, and this is a podcast called Maddie. The Maddie podcast series explores what many believe is the well-known story of Madeline McCann's disappearance. But this is an investigation of the evidence that could make you question everything you thought you knew about the case.
Making this podcast, I've had lots of conversations with people who have broadened and deepened my understanding of all manner of events relating to this case. And there were also times someone would say or infer something that would just kind of stop me in my tracks. I had one of those moments in a phone call with Portuguese journalist Duarte Levy. Duarte had been in Praia da Luz covering the Maddie story for local Portuguese media, and he was also filing stories for UK broadsheet The Times. To stay on top of developments and ahead of their rivals, English newspapers needed people with contacts and connections, journalists like Duarte, who could speak the language. Duarte was initially a little reluctant to speak with me. I suppose he was curious about my intent. When we did eventually speak, he told me how the Maddie case had affected a lot of people. I got the feeling he was including himself in that group. But as he relaxed and opened up, my conversation with Duarte turned in the direction of the DNA samples that had been sent to Britain for analysis. A couple of months after Maddie went missing, dozens and dozens of DNA samples were taken from the McCann's holiday apartment, 5A, and also from inside the boot of a car which had been hired by the McCann's, the silver Renault Scenic. This car was hired 25 days after Maddie went missing. That's critical. The DNA samples all came back judged to be inconclusive. But like so many things in the Maddie case, as I dug into this, there appeared to be layers of complex, sometimes murky detail beneath a seemingly simple answer. But anyway, here's Duarte Levy talking about the police investigation, and in particular, he's speaking about the decision of Portuguese police to send the DNA samples to a British laboratory in Birmingham, England, known as the FSS, the Forensic Science Service.
From the Portuguese side, there was one enormous mistake, one a very important fact that I still today, many years after, I would say that was a Gonçalo Brown estate. It was to accept that the DNA tests were made in UK. Portugal have labs for that, and if they wanted to make the test independently, they could ask France or Switzerland, countries where they have very professional labs, as professional as the one who was used in UK. And that was, my point of view, the most important mistake on this case.
I asked Duarte if he believed the results of the DNA tests would have been different if they had been tested somewhere else in Europe and not at the FSS in the UK.
Yes, I'd say yes. Don't forget that FSS, the results from that lab were on the other case were also questioned. So I'd say yes. That from the beginning, it was an enormous mistake, and Amaral recognizes today that when I asked...
Here, the quality of the recording of this phone call really deteriorates. But what Duarte told me is this, that on one of his visits to Praia da Luz, he asked Gonçalo Amaral why the DNA was tested in the UK and not in Portugal or an independent European country. Duarte said Amaral told him that there was pressure from above to do it that way. Amaral also said the move was to underline that Portuguese and British police were working together harmoniously, which wasn't actually always the case. I asked Duarte if he was hinting at the idea that the DNA tests from the UK weren't scientifically sound.
Well, I have no... I can't accuse them of that. The only thing I can say that from the preliminary reports, the final reports, from the reports made in UK to the reports who arrived in Portugal, there was substantial difference that affects the credibility of the results.
Duarte told me he thought the results probably could have been different if the DNA was not tested at the FSS. He spoke about a preliminary report and a final report and how there appeared to be substantial differences between the two. In just a minute, I'll play you some audio that underlines Duarte's thinking on this. But in short, what my conversation with Duarte made clear to me was this. He's got a few doubts about the DNA report that judged all the samples to be inconclusive. And if you read Gonçalo Amaral's book, well, he thought the same too. This episode of Maddie is going to explore and test some of the claims Duarte is making. To do this, I interviewed an American forensic expert named Dr. Mark Perlin. Dr. Mark Perlin is one of the world's leading DNA scientists. Dr. Perlin and his lab in Pittsburgh, USA, Cybergenetics, have successfully analyzed some of the most minute, challenging, and complex DNA samples for law enforcement agencies around the world. And those were the hallmarks of all the McCann DNA samples. They were minute, challenging, and complex. Mark's evidence has helped send murderers and rapists to jail. And importantly, Mark's DNA analysis has also freed men who have been imprisoned for crimes they did not commit. What Mark Perlin told me, well, it compelled me to make the phone call to Scotland Yard that you heard at the beginning of this episode. As Duarte Levy alluded to, there appeared to be confusion about the DNA reports. To underline this, I want you to listen to some audio of Sky News journalist Martin Brunt reporting live from outside the Portimao police station.
I've learned some important detail of the forensic test results, and they rather explain perhaps why the Portuguese police are so confident in their theory that Madeline's parents, one or other of them, played a part in their daughter's death. The details are these, that the samples that came back last week after British test in the UK, the samples produced three matches of Madeline's DNA. Now, in the apartment, police found one full match on a windowsill, a full match of Madeline's DNA. That's perhaps not so important because Madeline, of course, had been staying there for the best part of a fortnight with her parents. Now, in the hire car, which was hired 5 weeks after Madeline's disappearance, the tests have showed a partial match of Madeline's DNA, which might be explained by transfer onto clothes or other paraphernalia that the family were still using 5 weeks on. But this is the crucial thing. In the car, the scientists have also found a second full match. And police say that is the most damning evidence that's been returned by these forensic test results. And it shows, as far as they're concerned, the presence of Madeline's body in the hire car 5 weeks, at least 5 weeks, after she disappeared.
Okay, so a few things to note right here. First, to reaffirm, in stark contrast to the preliminary report, the final DNA report came back inconclusive. Second, Martin Brunt's report turned out to be inaccurate, as there were no full DNA matches, according to documentation in the publicly released official police files. And third, the rental car was hired 25 days after Maddie vanished, not 5 weeks. The DNA samples had the potential to be case-changing. If Maddie's DNA was shown to be in the back of the car, which was hired 25 days after she vanished, it would be explosive. It would seem to be a very difficult hurdle for any defense lawyer to overcome. And here's another thing to think about. The FSS in Birmingham, England, where those dozens of McCann samples were tested, it closed down in 2012. In 2007, the FSS was forced to undertake a massive review of up to 2,000 cases of violent crime, including rape and murder. There were concerns that the DNA tests relating to these criminal cases carried out at the FSS between 2000 and 2005 had failed to detect minute traces of DNA that could potentially have identified guilty parties. The FSS and the reliability of its DNA testing methods had been pushed under the microscope because of a review into the 1992 brutal murder of a young English woman named Rachel Nickell. Ms. Nickell, aged 21, was raped and stabbed 49 times in front of her 2-year-old son while they were walking in a London park, Wimbledon Common. It was a shocking attack that left a young boy leaning over his mother, begging her to get up. In 2017, that boy, Alex Hanscom, who is now in his late 20s, he spoke with BBC's Newsnight. His memory of that day is remarkably and frighteningly clear.
I remember everything, you know, waking up, waving goodbye to my father as he drove off in his motorbike to go to work. I remember, you know, walking hand in hand with my mother along Wimbledon Common, with Molly running around close to us, yeah. Yes. And then as we ventured deeper into the trees, there was a section that was covered by trees. So all of a sudden, we both sensed that there was something in the air. So we both turned our heads to the right quickly, and all of a sudden we saw this man lunging forward with a black bag over his shoulder. And then, you know, everything just happened.
In 2001, police gave a DNA sample potentially linked to the Rachel Nickell murder to the FSS for their scientists to analyze. The FSS ran the tests, but it failed to detect her murderer's DNA. 3 years later, in 2004, a rival forensic lab tested the same sample and successfully pinpointed the man who had raped and murdered her, a serial rapist and a serial killer named Robert Napper. In 2008, Napper pleaded guilty to Ms. Nickell's manslaughter. In 2007, the FSS also found itself criticised for missing vital DNA evidence in another high-profile murder case, the stabbing of 10-year-old London boy, Dami Lola Taylor. The FSS was undoubtedly a fine scientific institution, staffed by highly capable people. I'm not suggesting the organisation was incompetent or guilty of systematic failures. But what do the Rachel Nickell and Dami Lola Taylor DNA tests at the FSS show? It underlines the idea that DNA testing can sometimes be less than perfect. It can sometimes be wrong. It's not foolproof. And importantly, what I've learned through speaking with Dr. Mark Perlin is this. The DNA testing methods that forensic labs used in that era, including the FSS, and including the analysing of the McCann samples. Well, the methods, and therefore the results, were subjective and open to human bias. Today, more than 10 years since the McCann DNA was tested by the FSS, DNA technology has advanced. But even beyond that, Dr. Mark Perlin and his company, Cybergenetics, has developed a world-leading, incredibly powerful computer program called True Allele. True Allele produces accurate results on previously unsolvable DNA evidence. And importantly, unlike old DNA testing methods, the highly sophisticated computer algorithms used by Dr. Perlin remove all human intervention. There's no room for subjectivity or bias. The True Allele analysis is pure science. Dr. Mark Perlin's lab has been used by crime-fighting agencies in the USA, UK, Australia, and Ireland. In the US, it was used to help identify victims in the 9/11 attack on New York's Twin Towers. It was through Cybergenetics work in Australia that I met Mark. I was writing a story about how Cybergenetics and True Allele had successfully analysed a very, very small DNA sample in a shocking Sydney murder case. The state prosecutor called that DNA sample one of the most complex pieces of DNA evidence that had ever been brought into an Australian court. It helped convict a Sydney man, Robert Gia, in 2017, after he had crept into a house in the middle of the night and ruthlessly murdered a family of five. A tiny old bloodstain, which police found on the garage floor at the home of the murderer, proved crucial. In a dried smudge of blood, no bigger than the size of a thumbprint, all mixed together and jumbled up, were the DNA of at least four of his victims. Months later, out of interest, I sent the reports that the FSS had produced on the McCann DNA samples to Dr. Perlin in the US. I asked him to take a look at what a senior FSS scientist called Dr. John Lowe had written about the series of inconclusive results. I then asked Mark if the FSS had ruled out the possibility that the DNA in the boot of the car came from Madeleine McCann.
No, in fact, it specifically says that it could be her, but there's a balance of probabilities. As John Lowe wrote in his report, he needs to consider whether the match is genuine, these are his words, as opposed to whether the match came from chance. And that's exactly what all DNA match statistics do, whether it's True Allele or FSS methods or anyone's method, is you weigh a balance between the match being genuine versus the match coming from chance. The problem is, since his methods can't separate out the different people, he can't answer the very question that he wants to answer. He's posed the question, and he said it could be her, there could be a match, but without being able to balance it against the chance of coincidence, he can't tell. So he's asked the right question, and he doesn't rule out that it's her DNA, he just doesn't have the mathematics or computers to answer the question that he wants to answer.
Mark has worked on over 400 criminal cases, testifying about objective computer DNA evidence in state, federal, military, and foreign courts. He's a medical doctor and a double PhD holder. I reckon Mark could be the most rigorously analytical person I've ever spoken with. He's regularly on the road away from his lab in Pittsburgh, giving testimony in criminal trials where True Allele has been used to analyze DNA evidence. He's there to explain to jurors what the results mean. He gives testimony for both the prosecution and the defense. In fact, Mark tells me he works for nobody except justice and the truth. What I've found with Mark is that he's really good at explaining DNA jargon and the science into ideas and concepts that a layperson like me or a trial juror can easily understand. Here Mark describes the limitations of the FSS testing methods used by John Lowe and FSS scientists in comparison to True Allele, the computer program used by Cybergenetics.
Using a microscope analogy, if you're trying to diagnose a pneumonia and you need a 1,000-fold power microscope, but all you have is a hand magnifying glass, you're not going to make that diagnosis. You may want to. You may understand optics. You may understand bacteria. You may understand a lot. But if you don't have the microscope, you're not going to be able to look through it and make the diagnosis. And I think that's where he is here. He has a hand magnifying glass. He can do more than maybe he could have done 5 years before. But he doesn't have the tools to answer the questions that he's asking.
Mark has a lot more to say about the inconclusive FSS reports and what they might mean a little later. Jim Gamble, the one-time head of CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Agency, has told me the Madeleine McCann case can be solved. It's just a matter of how. DNA evidence could be crucial.
I believe that in my lifetime, we will actually find out what happened to Madeleine McCann. There will be a break, whether it's DNA, whether it's someone who was involved directly or indirectly, who's been struggling with their conscience, who actually saw something on that night that they've kept to themselves, who knew that there was someone at the time and at that time in that place who did something suspicious, who's never come forward. Maybe their relationship with an individual has changed and they now reflect on it and their conscience is weighing heavily. I think someone will come forward or something will be found to help us better understand this case.
And as you're about to hear, Mark Perlin could in fact have the DNA breakthrough that Jim Gamble was just talking about. But before we look at that, let's rewind to early September 2007, when Gonzalo Amaral and his team of detectives were anxiously waiting on the results of potentially crucial DNA tests. As we now know, the team of forensic scientists from the FSS in Birmingham had been busy analysing a large number of samples pertaining to the McCann case. Depending on the outcome, Kate and Jerry faced the possibility of being seriously implicated in the disappearance of their daughter, Madeleine. A DNA match would place Maddie in the boot of a car hired 25 days after she is reported missing. That would have raised serious questions about the events of May 3 and beyond. In episode 4, we looked at how cadaver dog Eddie had alerted behind a blue two-seat sofa that was in the living room of apartment 5A. The sofa was positioned against a wall, right underneath a window that looked out onto the small alley, the same small alley where Jerry McCann and Jez Wilkins had talked, the same alley where Jane Tanner made her sighting. Keela, the dog trained to only alert to human blood, had also signalled behind the blue sofa. Keela also alerted by the bottom of a long blue curtain which hung over the window and touched the floor behind the sofa. Unlike Eddie, who barks when he hits on something, Keela's signal when she alerts is simply to freeze and stand still. Similarly, after Eddie alerted by the driver's door of the McCann's Renault Scenic hire car, Keela searched the interior. The Springer Spaniel alerted inside the boot area of the hatchback. Remember, the work of cadaver dogs 100% needs to be backed up by corroborating evidence, such as DNA. And that's precisely the reason police forensic teams set about lifting up floor tiles around the blue couch and took swabs for analysis. They also cut out small pieces of fabric and plastic from the boot area of the Renault Scenic. As detailed in the lengthy police report, written up when the investigation into Maddie's disappearance was shelved, the final results of the DNA samples that had been analysed by the FSS did not corroborate the findings of the dogs. The report stated that initially there seemed to be the possibility of compatibility of Madeleine's DNA profile and samples taken from the Renault Scenic hire car, but ultimately, Dr. John Lowe of the FSS ruled that the results were inconclusive. To read a really important email that Dr. John Lowe sent to Portuguese and British police, where he explains his DNA analysis and why he found the samples from the car and apartment 5A to be inconclusive, go to 9.com.au/Maddie. Before we get to my interview with Dr. Mark Perlin, I just want to summarise the most important points that he explained to me. The crux of the problem was this. The FSS simply did not have the testing methods available to decipher the DNA samples that they were given. DNA forensics is straightforward when a lab gets given, say, a bloodstained knife and there's just one person's blood on the knife. But DNA forensics gets very complex when samples are small, sometimes microscopically tiny. An analysis is made even more difficult if that sample has DNA from two or more people mixed up in it. Take the DNA sample from the boot of the McCann rental car. The FSS declared the sample included DNA from at least three people, one of whom could have been Madeline McCann. But without advanced testing methods, they couldn't get beyond that part of the puzzle, so their results were ruled inconclusive. Dr. Mark Perlin explained to me how the FSS did not have the capability to strip out the DNA profiles of each individual person from the mixed sample in the car. Not being able to do that meant the FSS could not run a second test where statistical odds could have been put on that DNA belonging to Madeline McCann. What kind of blew my mind after speaking with Mark and him unraveling the background to all of this was this. The FSS never stood a chance of deciphering those potentially crucial DNA results. Here's Mark after I asked him, could the DNA taken from the hire car have come from Madeline McCann?
Based on the report that John Lowe wrote, yes, it could, but you'd need to calculate a match statistic to determine how probable that was relative to chance. What was interesting about the report from the FSS from 10 years ago is they're trying to interpret their data. The approach they'd like to take for a match statistic makes sense, but the way they're going about it is just very old-fashioned, and it doesn't work, certainly compared with modern methods. So the difference between modern computing like Droolio and the old FSS approach is that using all the data, Troulio would separate out the different genetic types of the people and then be able to make a comparison of each of those people's genetic types who are in the mixture with Madeline McCann. And if that comparison showed a strong match relative to coincidence, that would be an indication that she was present. And if it showed a weak match relative to coincidence, that would indicate that she wasn't present.
In 2016, Dr. Mark Perlin's DNA technology helped free two men who had been wrongfully imprisoned for a brutal 1989 gang rape of a woman in Indiana, USA. Before Mark Perlin intervened, one of the men, Daryl Pinkins, had served almost 25 years for a crime he never committed. The other man, Roosevelt Glenn, spent almost 17 years in prison. Both were convicted with dodgy evidence. But Troulio's analysis of the archived DNA evidence, it exonerated both men. Troulio untangled the DNA sample and found there were five men present in that sample, none of which were Daryl Pinkins and Roosevelt Glenn. So powerful was Troulio's analysis, it was able to successfully distinguish that three of the five men in the sample had incredibly similar genotypes and were probably brothers. Mark told me how and why Troulio had come to exonerate those two men.
What had happened is the DNA evidence that ultimately did exonerate him and free him from prison, that data was available 15 years before we ever looked at it. But it was limited methods of interpretation, methods that couldn't separate out the genetic types from the data, that couldn't make accurate comparisons, that couldn't produce statistics that excluded people, as well as merely including them, which is, you know, only one half of the equation. So imagine that you're in jail, and now you're in jail for 10 years for a crime you know you haven't committed, and there's DNA data. But so producing data is only the first part. An incomplete interpretation of the kind that most crime labs were doing at that time, or even today, meant that Mr. Pinkins stayed in jail. It was only when a computer program like Troulio, 15 years later, looked at the data, separated out the genetic types, and proved conclusively that he simply wasn't there. And in fact, there were four or five other people who were there, who were none of them the accused, but he was finally released from prison. So it's a similar situation in that if a lab can produce informative data, even if it's complex and mixed, but they can't interpret it, then you can have tremendous injustice of guilty people not being convicted, of innocent people staying in prison. And what's needed is an objective and accurate interpretation that can scientifically resolve the DNA.
Mark Perlin told me how John Lowe's FSS report did not rule out the possibility that the DNA in the car was Madeline. It was just that the FSS methods could not work out the answer. When I looked over the DNA report in the McCann files, over those dozens and dozens of DNA samples, where John Lowe had said that the samples were too complex and therefore could not be analysed, naturally I wondered what True Allele could do with that data. What might True Allele find, prove or disprove?
True Allele has been used successfully in England and Australia, Northern Ireland, in cases like this where there were complex mixtures, a small amount of DNA, many contributors, and True Allele was able to separate those mixtures, make comparisons, and reach sound scientific conclusions. Computers have no dog in a fight, and they can be validated, they can be tested, they can be used on mixtures with three, four, or five different contributors in a complex signal. That's what they're designed for. The fact that they couldn't analyze low-level data with three to five people in it is no surprise. Most labs can't if they're not using sophisticated computing.
The longer I spoke with Mark, the more I realized that True Allele might finally be able to answer some potentially vital questions about the Madeline McCann case. Here's the thing. Dr. John Lowe was only ever going to return an inconclusive result, regardless of whose DNA was in that small mixture of DNA.
The problem is, since his methods can't separate out the different people, he can't answer the very question that he wants to answer. He's posed the question, and he said it could be her, there could be a match, but without being able to balance it against the chance of coincidence, he can't tell. So he's asked the right question, and he doesn't rule out that it's her DNA, he just doesn't have the mathematics or computers to answer the question that he wants to answer.
I lodged multiple Freedom of Information requests to get the DNA data. Just to clarify, Mark's lab, Cybergenetics and True Allele, it doesn't need the actual DNA samples. They just need the digital numerical data that was pulled by FSS Labs way back in 2007. Mark has assured me that this digital data is routinely archived by the FSS and other forensic agencies around the world. But complicating my attempts to get hold of that data was the fact that the FSS shut down in March 2012, with the UK government citing massive monthly losses as reason for the closure. In my quest, I got pushed around government departments and was sometimes given conflicting information. I approached the UK Home Office. They told me to contact the National DNA Database. Then I was told to contact the Forensic Archive. The Forensic Archive told me that they had held the data, but it had been withdrawn for review in 2012. That's about the time Scotland Yard had begun its review, Operation Grange. I'll be looking at Operation Grange in a later episode. The Forensic Archive suggested I contact the Leicestershire Police. The Leicestershire Police refused my request. When it became apparent that my efforts to get the data had failed, I told Mark I'd been unsuccessful. I asked him what he thought of the Freedom of Information refusals.
Well, it depends what your goal is. There can be many different goals. There are other things people may be trying to protect. But if your goal is truth and your goal is the best science, then there's really no excuse for not opening up the data for better analysis by better methods. It'd be as if you found some old tissue from a person's body from 100 years ago, and And now we have better microscopes so we can analyze it. And some governmental agency said, no, let's only use the methods from 100 years ago that we know don't work. They failed then, they can fail now, and better methods with stronger microscopes or electron microscopes that could answer the question that we have, let's not use them. So the question you might ask is, why are they hiding the data that could answer the question? I mean, either, I don't know. I don't know why people hide data.
I think there are two extra points worth adding here. Maybe Scotland Yard have already conducted DNA analysis using computer-powered algorithms. If they have, they didn't use cybergenetics. And cybergenetics is one of only two companies currently analysing DNA with the computational testing methods Mark has been speaking about. The other is a New Zealand company called StarMix, who do work for the FBI and other police forces around the world. Of course, it's possible Scotland Yard have already engaged StarMix, but I contacted them and they were unable to tell me if that was the case. The other thing worth noting is the Scotland Yard investigation is still live, which means the FOI refusals are legitimate, if not frustrating. I asked Mark Perlin if he would like to get his hands on the DNA data.
Oh, that would be great. I mean, if you to be able to answer this question scientifically, as opposed to reading through dusty old reports of incomplete analyses, where someone's trying to interpret what they found using a failed method, that's not shedding any light. What this report says is there is a possibility that Madeleine McCann's DNA is present in this mixture. There's no evidence to the contrary, but in order to establish it scientifically, we need that original data file, which can be run through TrueAllele, to answer the question.
Knowing that I'd be phoning up detectives at Operation Grange, I asked Mark what he thought I should say to them.
I would explain to them how TrueAllele's been used successfully in the United Kingdom and elsewhere around the world to solve problems just like this. And if they want to know the answer, it won't cost them anything. Just send us the data and we'll give them the answer.
I also asked Mark how long it would take to do the tests and get an answer.
Well, it's taken a decade to get the data. I don't think you're counting that. But once we receive the data, we would know within a week or two. If these data files do exist in the FSS archives and the Metropolitan Police do have access to them, it would be a great way to resolve the case using modern technology and get a definitive answer to at least this one question that had perplexed the FSS 10 years ago.
Mark Perlin said he'd conduct the DNA tests for Scotland Yard and Operation Grange at no cost. Those tests could finally answer the critical question, was Madeleine McCann's DNA in a car which was hired 25 days after she vanished? That analysis could reboot this cold case. It could be a significant missing piece of the Maddie puzzle. So with that in mind, I called the special phone number Operation Grange had set up to receive information about Madeleine McCann.
The Operation Grange team is unavailable. Please leave a message.
Record your message at the tone. When you are finished, hang up or press hash for more options.
I left a message on the voicemail. I told them about Dr. Mark Perlin and TrueAllele. I told them how it could answer the question that the FSS had been unable to solve about the McCann DNA samples from 5A and the Renault Scenic. As I record this now, still, no one has contacted me to follow up that message. In the next episode of Maddie...
Yes, the documentary is even worse than the book.
Why?
It starts off stating right at the beginning that Madeleine is dead, that there was no abduction, and essentially claims that myself and my wife and our friends are liars and would be so cold and ruthless as to hide our daughter's body rather than try and then help her should something have happened.
Someone gives me audio recordings taken inside a Portuguese courtroom which have never been heard in public before. And a private detective hired by the McCanns tells me what they did and didn't do to find Maddie, plus the Find Madeline Fund, millions of pounds donated. Where did all the money go? The Maddie podcast is reported, written, and narrated by me, Mark Salnokonoko. Dan McHugh is our producer and sound designer. Simon King is our editorial advisor and editor. You can read more about this case and the podcast and see interactive graphics and maps on 9.com.au.